Good morning. When we take our youth to Boston, we find ourselves surrounded by UU history. There's a church on every corner, a grave, a statue. But who knew we had our own hidden UU history right here in Boise? Eight elementary schools in Boise are named for Unitarians, or people with strong ties to Unitarianism and liberal religion. Coincidence or conspiracy? You be the judge. So I've been interested in this for a while, at least since Elias started going to Longfellow and started realizing, oh, Longfellow's a Unitarian. And then my younger kids, Hallie and Dina, also go to Whittier. And Whittier is another one of those Unitarian schools. So I knew I had to share this. So when we talk about how we teach our children in Unitarian Universalism, one of the avenues is through the example of people who've lived their faith, who have made this world a little better. Each of these men, and they are all men, did some great things that make them worthy examples, and some things, I suppose, like the rest of us, that we cannot be so proud of. And hopefully we can learn from both of those sides. So what could the students in Boise Elementary Schools learn from writers James Russell Lowell, John Greenleaf Whittier, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow? What could they learn from the lives of three presidents, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and William Howard Taft? And one famous inventor, writer, diplomat, and rogue named Benjamin Franklin. Marcia and I are going to tell you a bit about each of these men and the schools named after them. Maybe, too, we'll have some reflections on what that all means.
The stories of Boise schools named for famous Unitarians have a little bit of everything to offer. Drama of biblical proportion in the form of fires, floods, the effects of diaspora caused by famine and war. Also, I think you'll find they are a continuous story of community planning and sacrifice for the betterment of children, as well as bringing the citizenry together for special pushes to bring about general societal improvements to our city. Changes in demographics of a growing frontier town, teachers and teaching, ideas about education, good and bad architectural plans, are all part of the interesting stories of these schools. According to local historian Art Hart, the schools were named for authors like Whittier, Longfellow, Lowell, and Hawthorne because students studied those authors and poets extensively in the early days of Boise's educational system. And Roger, from his neighbor, got some textbooks together that he's put on this front table of what they used, and they are a lot of Whittier and Longfellow, and just to kind of support what Mr. Hart said. He himself, Hart, remembered having to memorize many of the works of these famous writers as a student in the 1920s and 30s. So let's begin with Whittier School. Okay, Whittier was Boise's second elementary school and was added to the district in the late 1880s. It started with just four rooms at 12th and 4th Streets and went through numerous expansions. It had a fire where they lost the roof and replaced it with one that was flat, the beginning of the ominous flat roof choice that appears to have plagued our schools for decades. The original Whittier was closed in 1938, and there was no Whittier school in the district until 1949. When the post-war growth in families demanded a great expansion to the local school system. The current Whittier on 26th Street was built to serve the neighborhoods of the Chinese Gardens, Garden City now, and the neighborhood south of State Street. Today, Whittier is one of the most diverse in Boise. Almost 27% of its students are not native English speakers. It also serves a low socioeconomic group. 87% of the students participate in the free or reduced price lunch program. It has a dedicated group of experienced teachers with an average tenure at that school of 17 years, and 72% have master's degrees. In 2009, Whittier started a dual language program offering first and second grade instruction in English and Spanish. It's one of only two schools in the district to offer such a program. Today's Whittier School has been the focus of many BOOF social outreach efforts. Our Donna Pendley Memorial Fund donates money each year to the Whittier School Music Program to pay for musical instrument rentals, sheet music, and travel for young musicians. We also have collected and donated winter hats and gloves and contributed to weekend meal backpacks for students who may be at risk of going hungry without that extra food.
Before I start talking about Whittier the man, I need to make a disclaimer. Okay, so each of the people on this list of famous Unitarians, each of these people is on a list of famous Unitarians. However, it's not unequivocal. You can find different lists with different names on them. In the late 18th and 19th centuries, there were not organized Unitarian churches outside of New England, so that Jefferson thought Harvard should send UU missionaries down to Virginia to start some churches, because he had no place to go. We always hear that Ben Franklin was a deist, but there is no deist church. And you'll hear that his views are very compatible with Unitarians of his time. And sometimes it might be guilt by association. Whittier, for example, was friends with Longfellow, Lowell, Emerson, and shared many of their viewpoints, but the Quakers, including those in Greenleaf, Idaho, for which was named after him, claim him also. In any case, their religiousness and often their politics were different than the popular culture in which they lived. And then one more. Throughout, I've tried to use each man's voice, but forgive me for slicing and dicing passages that often go on for 3 and 4 pages, or if you looked at that book of Hiawatha, that is one poem. It was the style of the times. And that's what also I think Warren was struggling with, too, with Lowell. Lowell writes big old tomes, but learned a lot in all that.
Lowell's writings resulted in 10 volumes of printed material by the end of his life.
There you go. John Greenleaf Whittier came from a famous Quaker family, though we often claim him as a Unitarian. He was a contemporary and friend of both Emerson and Longfellow and an ardent advocate of the abolition of slavery. Whittier was a founding member of the American Anti-Slavery Society and signed the Anti-Slavery Declaration of 1833, which he often considered the most significant action of his life. As I mentioned before, the little town of Greenleaf, Idaho was named for him. In this poem, it's called The Greeting, was written as an homage to Harriet Beecher Stowe, and we can get an idea of the sensibilities of this man for whom Whittier School was named. Thrice welcome from the land of flowers and golden-fruited orange bowers to this sweet green-turf June of ours. To her who in our evil time dragged into light the nation's crime with strength beyond the strength of men and mightier than their swords, her pen. To her who worldwide entrance gave to the log cabin of the slave, made all his wrongs and sorrows known in all earth's languages his own, north, south, and east and west, made all the common air electrical until the overcharged bolts of heaven blazed down and every chain was riven. Ah, dearer than the praise that stirs the air today, our love is hers. She needs no guarantee of fame whose own is linked with freedom's name. Long ages after ours shall keep her memory living while we sleep. The waves that wash our gray coastlines, the winds that rock the southern pines shall sing of her. The unending years shall tell her tale in unborn ears. And when with sins and follies past are numbered color, hate, and caste, white, black, and red shall own as one the noblest work by woman done. So, critiques of religion, social conditions, and an homage to women. Sounds like a Unitarian to me.
Next up is Hawthorne Elementary. Currently located on Targhee Street on Boise's Bench, Hawthorne was actually Boise's third school and was originally a two-room school located at Mobley Drive and Warm Springs Avenue on the old Costin Estate. Their family cabin, by the way, is now in Julia Davis Park, and a daughter of that family actually taught or administered in Boise schools for over 40 years. Two-room Hawthorne School was replaced by a newer building in 1907 and operated at its original location until 1932. There was no Hawthorne School between 1932 and 1951. But again, as a response to post-war population growth and new neighborhoods south of Overland Road, the new Hawthorne School was built. It was originally made up of World War II barracks moved to the site, and later, in stages, an 18-room school was eventually built. Hawthorne, like many other Boise schools, suffered from leaks in the flat roof and got the hip roof remodel in 1989, as so many other Boise schools have needed. Today, Hawthorne serves a rather low-income student body. 67% are on the free or reduced price lunch program, and it also has one of the district's largest special education programs. That program serves 25% of Hawthorne's student body.
Nathaniel Hawthorne came from Puritan roots in Salem, Massachusetts. His ancestors included those who persecuted the supposed witches at the infamous Salem witch trials, a fact that haunts his writings. Although apparently not much of a churchgoer, Hawthorne hung with some of the biggies in Unitarian circles in the early to mid-1800s. At Bowdoin College in Maine, he became friends with Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and was involved in transcendentalism through his friendships with Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, beginning in the 1840s. Hawthorne was more than anything else intrigued about human beings' capacity for evil, our capacity to act out the part of Satan. His novels and stories are filled with characters who are portraits of human darkness, like Roger Chillingworth of The Scarlet Letter. But he knew not that the eye and the hand were mine. With the superstition common to his brotherhood, he fancied himself given over to a fiend, to be tortured with frightful dreams and desperate thoughts, the sting of remorse and despair of pardon, as a foretaste of what awaits him beyond the grave. But it was the constant shadow of my presence, the closest propinquity of the man whom he had most vilely wronged, and who had grown to exist only by this perpetual poison of the direst revenge. Yea, indeed, he did not err. There was a fiend at his elbow. A mortal man, with once a human heart, has become a fiend for his especial torment. The unfortunate physician, while uttering these words, lifted his hands with a look of horror, as if he had beheld some frightful shape, which he could not recognize, usurping the place of his own image in a glass. It was one of those moments which sometimes occur only at the interval of years when a man's moral aspect is faithfully revealed to his mind's eye. Not improbably, he had never before viewed himself as he did now.
Kind of dramatic. Well, the third school to talk about is Franklin School. Franklin School was shuttered in 2008 as part of a school district consolidation effort. But before that, what a history that school had. It was originally built in 1903, but saw as many as 10 additions, remodels, and facelifts during its lengthy tenure on Franklin Road and Orchard Street. Franklin School graduated many, many elementary school kids, but also high schoolers. It graduated its first high school students in 1908, got out of the high school business from 1911 to 1917, and then continued to graduate high school students from 1918 through 1949. It became part of the Boise District at that point and no longer offered secondary education. During the years, the school's many remodels give us a clue about its importance to the surrounding community. A construction bond in 1914 added two rooms to the overcrowded school, and a first edition for domestic science and manual training was executed in 1915. The school added a social room for community affairs in 1936, as well as even more space for domestic science and manual training programs. Twice, two-acre parcels were donated to the school to expand the campus. I have to admit it's a little sad to think of this historical school with so many students' memories and so many citizens having probably invested blood, sweat, and tears to it over the years to just come abruptly to an end 3 years ago. At this point, the school building's actually torn down.
So we know Ben Franklin as a rags-to-riches American story, a Renaissance man discovering electricity with a kite in a storm and comfortable in the French court, a diplomat, the wisest man among the framers, a guy you'd probably want to sit down and have a pint of grog with. We probably want him to be a Unitarian. Benjamin Franklin is clearly a deist in most of his views. He attended various churches, and he believed religion played a positive role in society and that the Bible was a strong moral guide. Like most deists, though, he questioned the Trinity and the resurrection and was skeptical of the miracles of Jesus, as were many of the Unitarians of his time. As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals and his religion as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. But I apprehend it has received various corrupt changes, and I have, with most of the present dissenters in England, some doubts as to his divinity. Though it is a question I do not dogmatize upon, having never studied it, and think it needless to busy myself with it when I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble. I see no harm, however, in its being believed, if that belief has the good consequence, as probably it has, of making his doctrines more respected and better observed, especially as I do not perceive that the Supreme takes it amiss by distinguishing the unbelievers in his government of the world with any particular marks of his displeasure. The faith you mention, Christianity, has doubtless its use in the world. I do not desire to see it diminished, nor would I desire to lessen it in any way, but I wish it were more productive of good works than I have generally seen it. I mean real good works. Works of kindness, charity, mercy, and public spirit, not holy day keeping, sermon hearing and reading, performing church ceremonies, or making long prayers filled with flatteries and compliments, despised even by wise men, and much less capable of pleasing the deity.
Next, I'll talk about Longfellow Elementary. Longfellow Elementary is on 9th Street in Boise's North End and was built in 1905 for $50,000. Early class sizes ranged from 39 to 60 students and served K through 8, as many early schools did. In the old days, noise from trolley cars going up and down 9th Street filled the classrooms. Longfellow currently celebrates its poetic namesake with quotes from Longfellow poems embedded in the sidewalk at the front of the school. Currently, it is an affluent and an innovative educational institution. Only 16% of the student body receive reduced lunch program benefits, and only 0.8% of the students are of limited English proficiency. Longfellow is an international school with a curriculum enriched by historic, geographic, and cultural extensions to its curriculum. They devote each month of the school year to intensive study of a specific country, looking at folk tales, art, geography, cuisine, and history in special student-based activities. They also offer Spanish language classes each week.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was a teacher at Harvard and Bowdoin, a translator of famously Dante's Divine Comedy, among other works, and a renowned writer in his day. He actually made significant money from selling his poetry. Check that out. Longfellow's influence by his Unitarian beliefs, his association with New England Transcendentalists, and the romantic literary movement he encountered in Europe. He sounds a tepid abolitionist, as he himself says about his collection of poems on slavery. The poems were, quote, so mild that even a slaveholder might read them without losing his appetite for breakfast. He was passionate about peace, though. Writing in his journal in 1878, I have only one desire, and that is for harmony. and a frank and honest understanding between North and South. His The Arsenal at Springfield, written in 1845, most effectively expresses his anti-war views. I hear even now the infinite fierce chorus, the cries of agony, the endless groan, which through the ages that have gone before us in long reverberations reach our own. On helm and harness rings the Saxon hammer. Through Kimbric forest roars the Norseman's song, and loud amid the universal clamor, o'er distant deserts sound the Tartar gong. I hear the Florentine who from his palace wheels out his battle bell with dreadful din, and Aztec priests upon their teocallis beat the wild war drums made of serpent skin. The tumult of each sacked and burning village, the shouts that every prayer for mercy drowns, the soldiers' revels in the midst of pillage, the wall of famine in beleaguered towns. Where half the power that filled the world with terror, where half the wealth bestowed on camps and courts, given to redeem the human mind from error, there were no needs of arsenals or forts. The warrior's name would be a name abhorred in every nation that should lift again its hand against a brother on its forehead would wear forevermore the curse of Cain. Peace, and no longer from its brazen portals, the blast of war's great organ shakes the skies, but beautiful as songs of the immortals, the holy melodies of love arise.
Next, we'll talk about Lowell Elementary. Lowell Elementary first opened its doors to students in 1913 on North 28th Street. Its playground abutted Sand Creek, where students would occasionally fall in, and the creek would also regularly flood the basement of the school about twice a year. Lowell grew very rapidly and had two major wing expansions. In the 1940s, it averaged 47 students per classroom. At its largest, it had four classes per grade for three grades and at least three classes for others. Lowell, like all Boise schools, experienced a major change in teacher demographics in 1943 when, as a result of the war, married women were allowed to teach. Before that, only single women or men, married or single, could teach in the schools. Lowell was known for a very active PTA with a record of 329 members in 1944, and 100 of those parents would regularly attend the meetings. Nowadays, Lowell is much smaller, with 269 students currently. 21% of the students have limited English proficiency, and 60% are part of the reduced or free lunch program. Lowell is quite proud of being chosen a Blue Ribbon School in 1994 by the U.S. Department of Education, and it has been a partner in education with the Idaho Department of Transportation for almost two decades.
James Russell Lowell was born in 1819, the son of the Reverend Charles Russell Lowell, Sr., a minister at a Unitarian church in Boston. So no doubt. He was a poet, an ambassador in Spain and England, a reformer, an abolitionist, the first editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and apparently not much of a student. Beginning in 1834, at the age of 15, Lowell attended Harvard College. Though he was not a good student, he often got into trouble. In his sophomore year alone, he was absent from required chapel attendance 14 times and from classes 56 times. In his last year there, he wrote, "During freshman year, I did nothing. During sophomore year, I did nothing. During junior year, I did nothing. And during senior year, I have thus far done nothing in the way of college studies." Good person to name a school after. Lowell was elected the poet of the class of 1838, and was tradition, was asked to recite an original poem on class day, the day before commencement. Lowell, however, was suspended and not allowed to participate. Lowell was also involved in a variety of reform efforts, including abolition. He urged for better conditions for factory workings, opposed capital punishment, and supported the temperance movement. His friend Longfellow was especially concerned about his fanaticism for temperance, worrying that Lowell would ask him to destroy the wine cellar. This would not be good. We are reading, we are singing a couple of songs that have Lowell words to them, so I'm actually going to skip this the poem that I have, because these poems go on. But I surmise that Lowell was a bit of a curmudgeon, so I'll leave you with one final Lowell thought. Whatever you may be sure of, be sure of this: you are dreadfully like other people. We like it.
I think so. Oh, well, next up, I'm going to talk about Jefferson Elementary School. Jefferson Elementary is one of Boise's most interesting schools. It is located on Latah Street on the Boise Bench and first opened its doors in 1949, immediately following the war. It was built to alleviate the crowding at Franklin and Whitney Elementaries. Originally just six rooms, it has tripled in capacity over the years. It also suffered from the district-wide, famously leaky flat roof, which was replaced in the 1980s. In current times, Jefferson educates many students whose parents and grandparents also attended that neighborhood school, but also serves students from over 19 countries who have relocated here as refugees. Somalia, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan are some of the nationalities represented in this incredibly diverse student body. At present, 21% of Jefferson's student body are of limited English proficiency, and 80% of the students participate in the free or reduced price lunch program. Our own Wanda Jennings has taught first grade at Jefferson for many years, and she has gotten many BOOF attendees involved in volunteer roles there. In visiting with Wanda a couple of years ago, she was pleased to report that all of her first grade students mastered reading that year. A very impressive accomplishment, especially considering that in that particular year, some of Wanda's little students knew no English when they started and were recently relocated from primitive village life, had never even experienced sitting in a chair. And I wanted to also mention that George Reno of our congregation taught there for, I see Patty, how long was he there? He was probably at Jefferson for 26, and Susie, you teach there too? So we have quite a few Jefferson people there, and George just retired last year. You know, he was the cool sixth grade teacher, right? So anyway, we have some representation there.
So we are aware of many things about Thomas Jefferson's greatness, author of the Declaration of Independence, our third president, who, among other things, sent Lewis and Clark out to explore what is now our home, and his failings. Failing to free his slaves or acknowledge his African-American children or mistress, despite his professed beliefs. The character of Jefferson's religion, though, is one of the most interesting aspects of his intriguing life. Certain evangelicals who were also his political opponents tried very hard to make Jefferson's religion a factor in elections. So this is nothing new, apparently. Jefferson never joined a Unitarian church. He did attend Unitarian services while visiting with Joseph Priestley after his immigration to Pennsylvania and spoke highly of those services. He corresponded on religious matters with numerous Unitarians, including John Adams. Jefferson considered Jesus the teacher of a sublime and flawless ethic. Writing in 1803 to the Universalist physician Benjamin Rush, Jefferson wrote, "To the corruptions of Christianity, I am indeed opposed, but not to the genuine precepts of Jesus himself. I am a Christian, in the only sense in which we wished anyone to be, sincerely attached to his doctrines, in preference to all others, ascribing to himself every human excellence, and believing he never claimed any other." Jefferson found the Unitarian understanding of Jesus compatible with his own. In 1822, he predicted that there is not a young man now living in the U.S. who will not die a Unitarian. Okay, well. Prognostication has not gotten any better. Jefferson requested that a Unitarian minister be dispatched to his area of Virginia. Missionaries from Cambridge, that is Harvard Divinity School, would soon be greeted with more welcome than from the tri-theistical school of Andover.
Okay, talking about now Adams Elementary. Adams Elementary was built at the end of Warm Springs Avenue in the 1950s. It was built on the site of the famous White City Amusement Park, an original natatorium, where many early Boise parties, galas, and even inaugurations were held. And it got its problematic leaky roof, flat roof, replaced in 1991. Adams has only 2.8% students with limited English proficiency, and only 16% are enrolled in the reduced price lunch program. Adams regularly exceeds district and state averages on standardized testing. It did start with grades 1 through 4 only, but it was expanded through a series of remodels.
If you have been on a UU tour of Boston and environs, you have seen the crypts of John Adams and John Quincy Adams beneath the UU Church in Quincy, Massachusetts. I think they're the only ones of that sort. John Adams always preferred Unitarian worship services. He wrote Aaron Bancroft in 1823, "The most afflictive circumstances that I have witnessed in the lot of humanity are the narrow views, the unsocial humor, the fastidious scorn, and repulsive tempers of all denominations, excepting one." That would be yours. However, during long years of service to his country, Adams could not always find a satisfactory congregational church and tried others. And congregational church, because, you know, if you go to Boston, they have churches, some are Unitarian congregational and some are Trinitarian congregational churches. So congregational was kind of the New England thing. Adams criticized predestination and expressed his belief in conscience. He said the fatalism of Mahometanism, materialists, pantheists, and Calvinists, and Church of England articles appear to me to render all prayer futile and absurd. He agreed with Jefferson that humanity had a moral sense as well as feeling. Emotion, however, may overcome reason unless it is restrained by society. Unable to understand the doctrine of the perfectibility of the human mind, he was even so cautiously optimistic about human nature. "I believe there is no individual totally depraved," he wrote Jefferson in 1817, "the most abandoned scoundrel that ever existed never yet wholly extinguished his conscience, and while conscience remains, there is some religion."
Okay. Finally, William Howard Taft Elementary. Taft Elementary was built in 1960, and it has undergone two major expansions. Taft is very proud of its comfortable interior and exterior spaces that include benches, rugs, soft music, plants, and fountains. And I have noticed myself as a visitor there that it is a truly attractive school. Taft was chosen as one of two of the district schools to have complete network computer systems for students and faculty in the early 1990s. As a result, Taft is very committed to using computers for the educational benefit of its students. Taft serves a large low-income population, with almost 83% of its students taking part in the subsidized lunch program. 16% of its students have limited English language proficiency. Taft Elementary has instituted a special summer day camp to ease the transition for new ESL students, English as a second language students, prior to starting the new school year.
So who knew William Howard Taft was a Unitarian? Okay. William Howard Taft is the only person to have served as both President of the United States and Chief Justice of its Supreme Court. The sole Unitarian president since Millard Fillmore, he remains the only Unitarian chief. How come there's not a Fillmore school? Wanda? it's like, really? he remains the only Unitarian chief justice. He's remembered for services to his fellow religious liberals and to the American Unitarian Association. From more of a schoolboy perspective, though, he's perhaps remembered as our largest president. When Taft took the oath of office in 1909, he had been immersed in politics for 4 years as the vice president. Under this stress, his weight had ballooned to 355 pounds. It was a constant source of public humor and commentary, both in writings and pictures. He did not enjoy being president. Dealing with a reluctant Congress, he turned to Unitarianism for solace. Taft became active in American Unitarian Association governance. In 1915, he was named president of the National Conference of Unitarian and Other Liberal Christian Churches. At the 1917 meeting of the National Conference in Montreal, Taft delivered a speech called the Religious Convictions of an American Citizen. It was the speech so many of his backers, which he had made in 1908 when he was being harassed for his religious beliefs when he was running for president. The American Unitarian Association gave it wide distribution. A Unitarian believes, he said, that Jesus Christ founded a new religion and a new religious philosophy on the love of God for man and of men for one another and for God and taught it by his life and practice with such heaven-given sincerity, sweetness, simplicity, and all-compelling force that it lived after him in the souls of men and became the basis for a civilization struggling toward the highest ideals. Unitarians feel the life of Jesus as a man to be more helpful to them as a religious inspiration than if he is to be regarded as God in human form. And also the creeds and dogmas that attach themselves to the religion of Jesus, needed perhaps in securing its spread among the nations in its triumphal march to a better civilization, have encountered the searching freedom of scientific intellectual inquiry and have shaken in the minds of many, not the essentials of Christian faith as we Unitarians believe them to be, but the incidental tenets of a rigid theology. Unitarianism offers a broad Christian religious faith that can be reconciled with scientific freedom of thought and inquiry into the truth.
So just to conclude, sort of provided for you the stories of the Unitarian Universalist named schools in Boise. And I just kind of thought, for those of us who didn't raise our kids here, or like me, haven't had anyone in public school for a while, it's an interesting tale of our changing community. I'm really proud that so many of our religious movement's founders were recognized at the times the schools were named, because clearly from Roger's material, their track records of artistic achievement, activism, and general social conscience are worth commemorating. At the same time, I think it's good to be aware of what interesting challenges our schools are facing currently. Our teachers, kids, and families are working together to meet the unique educational needs of our time, just as our predecessors met their own challenges, flooding creeks, fires, leaky roofs, crowding, war shortages, educational standards, and technology shifts, to name just a few.
So we're heading into the week when school starts. I hope this has seemed an appropriate topic of discussion. But the story of the men for whom these schools were named is a fascinating story about America and the role of public education in our lives. These are all men who challenged the status quo. Great and flawed individuals, critical thinkers who questioned politics, religion, and other orthodoxies. Some risked their lives. Some were armchair thinkers. Good role models and object lessons. Makes me wonder if we all remember the roots of our public education system.